Welcome to Manufacturing Talk Radio, the only show that takes a look at the obstacles and opportunities open to small to mid-sized enterprises that manufacture here in America. Brought to you by All Metals and Forge Group, with your hosts, Tim Grady and Lou Wise.
Welcome, everyone, to Manufacturing Talk Radio. My name is Tim Grady, host of the show, and I'm here with my co-host, Lou Weiss, who's also the sponsor of the show through his company, All Metals and Forge Group. And we're looking forward to a couple of very interesting conversations today. The first half of the show is going to be dedicated to what baby boomers can do with their companies if they don't have any progeny to pass it off to. Do they close it? Do they sell it? Do they merge it? And we're going to be talking with an individual on that subject. In the second half of the show at 1:30, we're going to be talking to Brad Holcomb, who's the committee chair of the Institute of Supply Management's Manufacturing Report on Business, which came out this morning about the ISM number and where those are going or where they've been for the last month. And hopefully we'll get kind of a sense of where it's going for September. But before we get to those two, I can't remember what I had for dinner last night, Lou. So what was the deal on last week's show? What did we broadcast last week?
I had fish last night for dinner. I'm eating good lately. Good morning or good afternoon, all. Last week's show, just to give you a little postscript about it, we discussed women in manufacturing, part one. Actually, part two is next week, and we had a couple of great guests talking about the case for women in manufacturing. And that there's more and more women entering manufacturing. There's all types of programs for them to create a career. We had Allison Grellis, president of Women in Manufacturing, and Karen Norheim, executive vice president of American Crane Company, discussing the evolution of women in manufacturing. And I think that may even wind up helping the gray hair departure from manufacturing world. So there's a couple of topics that we can mix in and have a better understanding about what's happening in the employment world within manufacturing. That said, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that WIM, Women in Manufacturing Summit, is going to be held on September 23rd through the 25th in Minneapolis at the WIM Summit 2015. We will be there also, and we'll be interviewing a couple of the guests, and that should be a fun event, Minneapolis in the end of September. That said, a couple of news items this morning. Well, first of all, there's the ISM report did come out. But I'm not going to take Brad Holcomb's thunder and tell you what happened. You'll have to tune in and listen for his report in about a half hour from now. It seems as though that the China stock market has taken a major hit today. It seems as though the U.S. stock market is down about 400 and some odd points today. I'm not going to tell you why. It seems as though their National Manufacturing Day kickoff event is coming September 28th, which we're also going to be at. And I might add that Tim and I are proud to be the keynote speaker at the Manufacture New Jersey kickoff event at Newark, New Jersey. So, Tim, I think that's about it for me. Why don't you introduce our guests and let's get rolling. Tim, I gather you're not there. So, Michael, are you here?
I am, Lou.
Yeah, it looks like I have technical difficulties and have lost Tim for a moment. We'll get him back online. I'd like to introduce Michael, and you're going to help me with your last name so I don't really screw it up.
It is Schwartzfeger.
Schwartzfeger. Okay. Michael is from the M&A world, and he deals with small to medium-sized companies and as to what they're going to do with their companies, as to close it, sell it, merge it, whatever the game plan best suits the owners. So, Michael, welcome to Manufacturing Talk Radio.
Thank you so much, Lou. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for having me.
Great. So give us a little background about your organization, Chapman Associates.
Sure. So Chapman Associates is a lower middle market merger and acquisition firm. Just that's a fancy way of saying that we sell companies in the lower middle market. Our sweet spot is of companies that have an enterprise value of somewhere between $5 and $50 million or so. We help companies sort of through the planning process, finding a potential partner acquirer, and then getting the transaction done. We've been around for about 50 years or so and have offices all around the country.
How many offices do you have?
About 15.
Oh, excellent. Before that, your interview is over, we'll get you to give your contact information. We do broadcast all over the world, but specifically the U.S., so somebody might have interest in having further discussions with you.
Happy to do that.
Tim, are you back with us?
I'm back with us. We had a little technical difficulty, so I dropped off the air momentarily. Mike, glad to be back with you on the show. Kind of an interesting economic time we're in right now. You know, we've been talking on the show about the looming skill gap in manufacturing, where the gray hairs are retiring out of manufacturing, and the millennials are coming in, but there's a lot of knowledge that goes with the gray hairs when they go. You have to be facing the same thing in the mergers and acquisitions world when someone looks to buy a company, and the owner is going to sashay out the door. How do you keep the brain drain from hurting the company when that happens?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I think it's really kind of goes to the heart of how to make your company the most valuable as you're looking to exit or positioning to retire or whatever your plan is, and that is there's a huge difference between companies that that allow that brain drain to occur and companies that set themselves up for a more orderly transition, and unfortunately for the companies where a lot of the knowledge is contained in one person's head or in a couple people's head, those companies have a tough time kind of surviving that transition.
I also have to ask, because this frequently comes up, having been around that world a little bit, is there a tendency for the owner of the company to believe that his company is worth something much more than buyers are willing to pay? Is that a real difficulty for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's always sort of a valuation gap between buyers and sellers. And hey, look, it's an emotional process, and people want their businesses to be worth sort of what they hear on the radio about businesses being sold for, and a lot of times that isn't realistic and it doesn't really match the market for smaller middle-sized manufacturing companies.
And what's been happening in your experience in manufacturing? Are there a lot of transactions happening in the middle market manufacturing arena?
Yeah, the last couple of years have been a very robust cycle in the M&A space. I mean, obviously, in kind of the downturn a few years ago, nothing occurred, and there was a lot of pent up demand coming out of the recession. So, from 2012, 13, 14, 15 and particularly 14 and 15 has been very robust in all sectors, including manufacturing. Just a lot of transactions have taken place. Both at very high levels, and the mega merger, as they call it, and as well as the middle market.
So, Mike, what can the business owner do to prepare his business for sale?
Well, there's a handful of things that are really important to do, and I think the important piece to all of it is to start early, plan ahead, and really think through what it is you want to accomplish. You know, there's so many different transactions that occur, and just to kind of digress for a second, and sort of the assumption we've sort of been talking about is that somebody is ready to retire and transition their manufacturing company. But what I found in doing this for quite some time is that there's many people that come to me that have reached some other constraint other than age that they're looking to grow their company, and they just don't have something necessary to grow it any further. Sometimes that's the cash they don't have in their pocket, or they don't have a set of skills that are necessary, or they're really a good salesperson, but they're not a really good CEO, or vice versa. And so I think the important thing really to start from is to think ahead and think about what it is you want to do and what is this sort of ideal transaction look like. And then you need to start, you know, making the changes inside your organization or growing your organization in a direction that aims at the outcome you'd like to have. So, you know, looking at it from, you know, just a couple of perspectives, I mean, in some very, very concrete things that people can do that often mid-sized businesses sort of have not done is really to invest in the right kinds of people and processes and procedures that make your company more worthwhile and more valuable to an acquirer.
I have a question, Michael. I know that these transactions can tend to drag on 6 months, a year or more. And in the preparation to prepare your company, making sure you have the right managers and the right skill sets and so on, is there anything that needs to be done within the corporate structure to prepare your company for a better deal for yourself?
Yeah, that's a great question. In that, I run into a lot of companies that are looking to be sold in their C corporations, and you know, most people know that C corporations have kind of a double layer tax structure. In other words, the C corporation pays tax internally on what it makes, and then distributes dollars up to the owner, and then the owner pays taxes on what he takes, and that is very, very problematic in a transaction, because a lot of times a buyer will want to buy the assets of the company, and I know I'm kind of going into technical detail here, but I mean going buy the assets instead of the stock of the company, and what happens is when a company sells the assets and it's a C corporation, the company gets taxed, and then after the dollars are distributed, the owner gets taxed again. So yes, looking at what your goal is and when your exit looks to be, it's important to structure your company in a way that you know maximizes the value. Similarly, you know, moving things around between organizations, between you know, if you have different subsidiaries, putting things in their you know in the right buckets can be really a value adder to you know both the company's value and then also to what you put in your pocket as the owner of the company.
Well, I know that in terms of the IRS, they don't like seeing you convert from a C to an S and then 2 days later sell the company. So what's the safe time frame for you to make that switch so that you're not looked upon as being anti-American?
Yeah. That you're referring to something that's known as the built-in gains tax, and the built-in gains tax window has been a moving target over the last few years, as our government's been sort of unable to really coherently pass a tax policy. That window for change has moved around from 10 to 7 to 5 years, kind of every single year, and I believe that the last tax extenders law changed to 5 years, but I believe that also ended effective the end of last year. So it's probably going to be 5 years, but it's something that you definitely need to get your accountant to give you some help on.
I'll be right back. I'm going to go call my accountant.
Oh, the rule. You know, it's craziness, right? I mean, this is one of those things I use as a great story because the world for owners of companies has literally changed, like, you know, every year, usually retroactively. So it's a tough place to be.
Well, you did refer to our government being what was the word you used? Coherent. Which we try not to pick on anybody except the government, so that's okay.
Mike, you know, there's always the question about taxes. You know, when you're, particularly if you're a subchapter S, but C-corps as well, you're trying to minimize your tax liability. So, you know, you're trying to drop the smaller net before you get taxed. And then you go to sell the company and you've got a problem with your valuation. So do buyers now understand that there's value there that they can recapture, or does it really have to show up on the valuation documents and balance sheets and you spend 3 years paying heavy taxes preparing yourself for a sale?
You know, the answer to that is buyers understand that middle market companies don't like paying taxes.
Well said.
Without advocating tax fraud or anything like that. I mean, I don't want to go much further than that. But people understand that's what's going on in corporate America because of the way our tax structure and tax systems work. But I think that the real key for people that are looking to do a transaction is to be transparent, be clear on your financials so that when someone like me comes in and tries to understand where dollars are going and what decisions you've made and what sort of investments you've made and where you've accounted for those, it's easy for me to understand that. What I really run into with a lot of, you know, very sophisticated, otherwise sophisticated companies is financial structures that are financial systems that are indecipherable, right? I mean, they're using systems that don't really match, you know, anything, again, coherent, but, you know, much less generally accepted accounting principles. And I've seen clients that are, you know, $30, $40, $50 million in revenue that don't have a real firm handle on what they make. So I think, you know, I think this, what your question really kind of dives into is the overall picture, which is, it almost doesn't matter what you do as long as you can explain it well. And that's sort of the best advice I can give anybody on the financial front is set yourself up so that you can explain it to me or to you. It doesn't really matter. Explain it to somebody and make sure they can understand it.
Getting a little off topic, when you engage a company to help market the company, can you go through perhaps the steps that you would discuss with them right up through what their financial responsibilities are to you as the M&A person before a deal goes down? Or are there no financial requirements until the deal goes down?
There's a couple different models, Lou, in doing this, in selling companies, which I think is what you're asking about. And there's, mm-hmm. there's really two pieces of compensation. There's financial responsibility to an M&A person. There's a retainer piece, and then there's a success fee piece. And depending on what firms you hire and sort of where people fit into the marketplace, there's a different balance between those two pieces. Chapman Associates, we made a decision a long time ago to be a success fee-based organization and to only in very rare cases charge retainers because we just think it's a better model and allows us to be to match our incentives with our clients' incentives. But on the other hand, there are very, very good firms out there that charge a retainer, and the sort of the concept behind that is there's a lot of people that are not committed necessarily to selling their company and are looking to do a transaction or looking to kind of learn about a transaction rather than do a transaction. And putting a little bit of a retainer up front, you know, kind of measures their commitment to the process. So I think those are the two models, and you know, not surprisingly, people that charge a retainer tend to charge a little bit lower success fee. People that don't charge a retainer charge a little bit higher success fee in order to compensate for the risk. But those are the really kind of the two models that are out there.
Well, talking about the deal, you have an e-book out there called The Inner Workings of a Deal, Tips for a Successful Transaction. Can you give our listeners some insight into that, and at the end give us the URL address where they can download it and have their own copy of and their takeaway for that topic?
Yeah, absolutely. So the reason I wrote that book is because I spent a lot of my time, not surprisingly, with clients that don't understand what a transaction looks like, and there's no reason they should. They manufacture whatever they manufacture. I'm in the deal business; they're not, so they don't even necessarily understand what sorts of transactions are even available. You know, whether it's a majority recap or a complete buyout or something else. And they don't really understand kind of where they're going and want to go. So I tried to put together a pamphlet that really kind of goes through soup to nuts, you know, front to end, the transaction process, from sort of thinking through what your goals are to doing some of the preparation work that we've talked about today, talking to your accountant, talking to a deal accountant, not just a tax preparer, but, you know, a real accountant that has skills in a transactional sense. Making sure that your estate plan's in order, hiring an intermediary, going through some of the things we just talked about, and then walking through the whole transaction process, from, you know, putting the marketing package together to deciding who to market to, all the way through, you know, the due diligence process, what to expect. Don't read that part if you want to ever really want to sell your business. It's a very stressful part of the process. You won't like it no matter if you read about it or not. And then all the way to the end about what to expect in terms of the documents and the closing and things like that. So it's really just tried to be a primer for somebody that has never been through a transaction before to understand what they're in for as they go forward from, you know, with the thought of selling their company.
And where can our listeners get their free copy?
They can get that at www.mbsmergers.com.
Mike, these transactions kind of have their own emotional component, which can either have a successful outcome or blow it apart at the last possible second. What kind of things tend to cause these transactions to go south in terms of that emotionality?
Well, I think it's really the emotional tie that that business owners have to their businesses. I mean, at the end of the day, I would say I spend a good third to 40% of my time really being a therapist more than being any kind of analyst or lawyer or any sort of, you know, business negotiator. Because most of the people that are going through this that we represent, are, like I said, have done this never before, and they'll never do it again. And it's the most significant transaction they'll ever do in their lifetime. They've lived with their company. They've grown it from often, you know, literally one man in a garage someplace to now a $30 or $40 million revenue business, and they don't really know what to expect. And you know, I think that's why I fully advocate, you know, just getting educated about the process, getting educated about what to expect, not just through the transaction, but after the transaction, getting educated as to what the potential outcomes. Kind of going back to your question about, you know, the value gap between buyers and sellers, understanding what the market looks like, what kind of deals are there really out there for my company, what are the possible outcomes. It's just a really important thing to avoid that emotional sort of disconnect at the very last minute.
So we've got about 5 minutes left, Mike. Have you got any not to name names, but if you got any great stories that you've experienced while you've been doing this, either positive or negative, you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I think that really that my great stories are really just along the same lines as we've been talking about, and a lot of the, you know, but, you know, I had a client that was a very very successful company a few years ago, and but But just to kind of illustrate, they were much larger than some of the other companies I've discussed here today, but didn't have a really great process and infrastructure in place, doing phenomenally well, very successful. And going through the process, you know, we covered all of the types of things that we talked about today. You know, we even though they were very, very large, we learned through the process that they didn't have a very good financial system in place, that buyers were sort of, you know, scared about. They had, you know, very interesting, successful, but concentrated customer base. We got to the end of the process and the client was, you know, he yelled at me because he was so stressed out about the due diligence. And, you know, by the way, I always say that that's always a good thing. When the client yells at me, I know we've gotten through the tunnel and we're coming out the other side, because it always happens in every deal. But ultimately, you know, they found a great buyer in a private equity firm that was able to put in place a CEO to replace the CEO that wanted to retire. They were able to put a new CFO in place to really bolster and upgrade the financial systems. I know since then they've been working really hard at acquiring a very strong competitor of theirs, and you know, so the outcome was phenomenal and the outcome was great, but boy, it the whole thing really demonstrated that there's never an easy transaction, even in this marketplace at all. And but just working together with the client and working together with the buyer and kind of getting through the process, it just takes a lot of work and a lot of diligence. But you know, at the end of the day, everybody was excited, everybody was very happy with the outcome, and I think it just goes to show, if you kind of work through the process, it's a good space to be in.
Mike, the due diligence process quickly, what makes it so painful?
Well, what makes it painful is that buyers are inherently risk averse. I tell people that buyers hate bad deals more than they like good deals. So they will look at every single thing inside your company. And I have yet to have a client that doesn't call me and say, what on earth do they need this for? And it doesn't really matter what this is, because it's always something or some things. So, you know, they're going to look at your every bit of your financials. They're going to send a financial, you know, analyst in, usually an accounting firm, to check your bank reconciliation statements. I mean, they're going to look at, you know, every contract for copiers you have, your forklift leases. They're going to look at, every argument you've ever had with a customer or an employee or anything ever in your lifetime. And it's just a process that just, it grates on you. And you have to get through it, because there's no deal if you don't, but it's just a very draining process. And it's something that, you know, if you can bring people in, like whether it's somebody like me, whether it's a lawyer, whether it's an accountant, to help you get through that process and prepare for it in the early stages, again, it's just, it'll make it easier, but I don't care how easy we possibly make it, you're still going to be upset by at least one time through that process.
I can understand
What is a safe time period, Michael? To prepare
a time period
in advance.
To prepare yesterday. I mean, it doesn't. It's never too early to start thinking about this, because there's so many things that you can do well in advance that are easy, right? I mean, we can look at your financial statements and say, hey, you really might want to change this over the next couple of years, and it's something that some business owner may not even think about. Maybe a very easy change, but trying to change it the day before a transaction is very difficult. Same thing, trying to coach an executive or an owner into, maybe delegating some more responsibility or bringing on somebody or teaching someone, so there isn't that brain drain we talked about at the beginning of the show. I mean, those are the kinds of things that are easy transitions to make years before a transaction, but they're very, very difficult, if not impossible, to make, as you're nosing up on trying to sell your company.
Michael, I want to thank you for being on the show. Information was great. We're going to take a quick commercial break. If anyone would like more information about Mike's company, Chapman Associates, please check on MFG Talk Radio. We'll have some links back to his website. And we'll take a quick commercial break, and we'll be back with Brad Holcomb from the Institute of Supply Management.
Thank you, Michael.
Manufacturing Talk Radio will be right back.
How do you keep your business humming? Where do you go when you're looking for quality suppliers of new equipment? Components, MRO supplies, repair services, or even raw materials.
American Crane and Equipment Corporation in Douglasville, Pennsylvania is a leader in specialized cranes, hoists, and material handling equipment for industries including...
How do you keep your business humming? Where do you go when you're looking for quality suppliers of new equipment? Components, MRO supplies, repair services, or even raw materials. 30 years ago, you would have turned to the Thomas Register. Today...
American Crane and Equipment Corporation in Douglasville, Pennsylvania is a leader in specialized cranes, hoists, and material handling equipment for industries including aerospace, nuclear, oil and gas, transit, construction, and waste handling. Call 877-877-6778 or visit americancrane.com. That's americancrane.com or 877-877-6778.
All Metals and Forge Group is an ISO 9001 AS and EN 9100 manufacturer of open die forgings and seamless rolled rings in alloy, carbon, stainless and tool steels, aluminum, copper, titanium, and nickel alloys. Visit us at steelforge.com or call 800-600-9290. Welcome back to Manufacturing Talk Radio.
We are.
We're back
and
now with
Brad Holcomb.
Lou and Brad Holcomb from the Institute of Supply Management. Brad, welcome to the show.
It's always a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Brad, you've been busy this morning. What's going on with the ISM number? What's the toughest question you've had so far today?
You know, it's been very, very interesting. You know, the PMI is at 51.1. I think it's below a number of expectations. But I really appreciate the time to talk about this in a little more depth than what I've been doing all morning, you know, 5, 10, 15 minutes on, you know, the other outlets. Is sometimes not enough time to really delve in and understand what's going on here.
Well, this is your home.
This is my home, and
right.
We appreciate it very, very much. So let's talk about the PMI and what constitutes it and kind of what's going on, if you will.
Great.
You know, as I said, the PMI is at 51.1. It's actually the lowest point of the year, and it's also the lowest since May of 2013, so a couple of years plus. And yet new orders, production, employment, and supplier deliveries are all above 50. We'll talk about those one by one. And inventories at 48.5 is in a well-controlled region as well. All told, 51.1. Now, what does it mean? First of all, it means that we're growing. It means this month is better than last month. We've been growing for 32 consecutive months in terms of the PMI. But the growth has been modest all year long. Some would even say lackluster, but I'll say modest. And let me be specific. The average PMI from January through August is 52.4. So 51.1 this month, that is August, is only 1.3 percentage points below that average. And so I will say that it's a continuation of a modest growth year that we've experienced since January. This was all much less than was expected when we and others forecast the year in December last year. Nevertheless, things happen. We've talked about the things that happened early in the year, you know, the weather, the West Coast port situation, the stronger dollar, et cetera. And a lot of those things cleared up, but now we have new things that are being, you know, talked about and either directly or indirectly impact the situation. Okay.
Well, that's certainly positive news. I appreciate the comparison to the average for the year so far, because that's encouraging. I know everybody's kind of watching this and seeing it slowly decrease here. I don't know that anybody's hitting the panic button, but nobody's feeling real warm and fuzzy either.
Right.
What's the report kind of saying? What are the respondents saying? That you know, where are the strong points in the economy and where are the weak ones?
Yeah. Well, the comments, as usual, are very, very interesting. And as we talk many times, they're more forward-looking than the numbers for the months per se. And a lot of the comments, and we'll get into the specifics, are positive in terms of growth and range from modest to steady to strong growth, depending upon the industry, and also reflect the positive impact of falling oil prices and raw material prices to go along with it, but also express concern over the strong dollar and lower exports. So let's look at a few. The first one from the food, beverage, and tobacco products industry: falling crude oil prices are benefiting all resin-based purchases, in other words, packaging and bottles, as well as positively impacting fuel surcharges for inbound products. So a plus-plus from the food, beverage, and tobacco industry. Next, a real short and sweet one from paper products: we are oversold. Transportation equipment. Business is still strong, but has slowed slightly. Okay, let me just keep going, because I think they're all interesting and insightful.
Okay.
From the chemical products industry, which is one of our very largest industries that we follow, modest growth, slightly ahead of GDP. Optimistic for the remainder of the year, as we have little international exposure, right? So there's a little teaser in there that they don't have international exposure, and so the domestic outlook is optimistic from that particular respondent in the chemical products industry. Now a comment that addresses foreign exchange. Foreign exchange continues to be a challenge, especially in Europe. overall, though, the mood is fairly upbeat regarding the second half of 2015 as we ramp up for a new product launch. That's from the computer and electronic products industry. And we all know that that industry introduces new products in the fall. And so this is a reflection of that. Fabricated metal products, near and dear to your hearts, is our hosts. Our business is good due to the increase in commercial construction. Does that ring true for you?
Pretty much.
Good.
I could give you some more opinions of the 51.1, but this is your show.
Well, let me keep going. And if we have any time for your comments, we'll address it at that time.
Thanks. Just flip it back to me.
So from miscellaneous manufacturing, raw metals price decrease will impact our business favorably. Okay. We talked about that many times. Now, from wood products, a little bit of a mixed message here. Business is guarded but steady. Margins are tight, markets are very competitive, and China is lackluster. So there's a specific comment about China that we hear a lot about, and we try to figure out what it means. Here's from Wood Products. It's saying it's having a specific impact. Machinery, again, one of our largest industries that we follow. Automotive companies are investing heavily in upgrading their equipment. So that's a real positive for machinery as we go forward over the long term. And then finally, from furniture and related products, business is strong and doing well. Labor continues to be a struggle to find. Okay. So my sense is there's a lot of positives there on a forward-looking basis, even some positives in the falling crude oil price scenario, reflecting lower raw materials prices, reflecting the fact that it costs less to run our factories, although there's also concerns about exports that are cited and implied here due to foreign exchange and China in particular.
And for our listeners, Brad, I'm going to have you go through your manufacturing at a glance, but this report can be picked up at the Institute for supplymanagement.org, and I encourage any of our listeners to pull up the report and take a look at this next chart that Brad's going to explain, because this is really the meat of this report. Terrific information. Brad, go ahead and walk through that.
Right.
I just want to mention one point. If for whatever reason you can't get the report at ISM, you can get that same report from manufacturingtalkradio.com. So you have two avenues to be able to get that report easily. Brad?
Yeah, I think we linked over to it. Go ahead, Brad.
Very good. Good. Again, the PMI is comprised of five factors, equally weighted. First, new orders. That's down 4.8 percentage points to 51.7. You know, a fairly sizable drop. And if you look at the specifics, we have seven industries reporting growth, and we have seven industries reporting a decrease, which means there are four that are standing pat from last month, even with last month. Now, the seven that are reporting growth are in total larger than the seven that are reporting declines, because the index remains positive. And let me just tell you what those industries reporting growth are. First, textile mills, next, plastic and rubber products, then paper products, chemical products, food, beverage, and tobacco, miscellaneous, and then computer and electronic products, which is actually the largest industry that we follow. And the seven that are reporting a decline, in the order of most decline to least decline, is number one, wood products, then apparel, leather, and allied products, followed by electrical equipment, appliances and components, primary metals, petroleum and coal products, machinery, and fabricated metal products. Okay. So fabricated metal products is on that list, but it's at the end of the list, which means the least amount of decline of any on the list. Okay. And production is down as well, 2.4 percentage points to 53.6. You know, nicely above 50 once again. And production shows eight industries reporting growth, five industries reporting a decrease, and so there, you know, several that are standing pat from last month as well.
One point I'd like to point out is that the numbers, and if any of you listeners go to the site and actually print out all this report, there's a very nice chart that shows all these numbers, and there's one thing that I think should be stated, that these numbers, even though it's the summertime, and this is August, which typically there are more people on vacation at this time, that you might think would reflect a downturn in these numbers. But You want to explain, Brad, about your seasonally adjusted configuration?
Yeah, that's always a great reminder. In January each year, we run a seasonalization process to take out the normal effects of seasonal variation, like, you know, summer vacations and, you know, winter time versus summer, the weather effects, all of those things that we feel and see similarly year over year over year. So when we do that, each month should look like any other month. In other words, we take that seasonal effect out.
Okay, that
That's
being
a
said,
very, very good point. Mm-hmm.
That being said, I'm having a hard time with the minus 4.8 on new orders.
Right.
The as to what's causing such a huge drop. And it is a huge drop, I think, by any standard.
Well, it is a large drop. We actually had a 4.9% decrease fairly recently. And let me see when that was. That was in January of this year. Okay. So it's not unprecedented even in this year. Nevertheless, it's something to definitely notice. So what is going on there? I mentioned, you know, how we got started this year and all of these sort of headwinds and situations that we faced with and got through. You know, I'm surmising, and everything that I see here in our report plus the news, that there's an uncertainty factor that's weighing on everyone's mind. And I'll get to that detail in just a moment in terms of my thinking. But it's potentially keeping people's, you know, dollars in their pockets more so than they would otherwise. And to me, those uncertainty factors are, you know, concerns about the global markets. You know, people read the press, they read the newspaper, they turn on the TV, you know, they hear about China, and you know, that creates uncertainty or concern, although it doesn't impact our fundamentals necessarily, at least in that time frame. The other piece of uncertainty is the Fed action or inaction. Will it happen? Won't it happen? And if it happens, what does it mean? Okay. And then finally, and certainly not least, but last, the stock market roller coaster that we're on. Again, that doesn't necessarily directly relate to manufacturing, but it does cause concern, and concern generally has people keeping their wallets in their pockets. That's my theory, my hypothesis, in just putting, you know, several things together, which I recommend to your audience. We all need to look at various reports, various pieces of news, and be in tune with what's going on to make sense of this report and the economy in general.
Just as a point, the Dow presently is minus 388 as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
recovered a little bit from its 433.
Yeah, it was down to 460, I think, at one point. With the concern of the Chinese and their Chinese market collapse today also.
Nonetheless, Brad, employment seems to be holding up pretty well.
Well, you know, so far, you know, employment at 51.2, that would generally suggest, you know, positive news when the government comes out with their statistics later on in the week. Anything above 50.6 in our index generally corresponds to an increase in the Bureau of Labor Statistics number for factory employment. So we'll see if that general rule holds up. But again, our number is that we have more people on board this month than last month when we have a number above 50. All right, let's go to supplier. Go ahead. Do you want to?
No, I just wanted to make a comment. You know, looking at your the numbers within the report, and we've really talked mostly about the last 6 months, or at least since beginning of January. But if you take a look at the 12-month running, the PMI numbers were at 56, 58, 57, 55, and so on, and then started its slide into March, April at 51 and change, 52, 53, and now we're back at 51. And the trend, just the last 12-month trend, seems to be sliding to a point where it's much slower growth. And I recognize the growth factor, but I guess I like seeing getting three orders out of every 10 instead of one order out of every 10.
Right. I understand. We all like that. But at the same time, you know, we can't just keep going up, up, up. There has to be, you know, some tempering along the way. And just like the stock market, hopefully with not those wilder swings. But nevertheless, no, I agree with you. This has been a modest year at best. And it's because I think in part that we started off with these, you know, problems, the weather in January, the West Coast port, and so on and so forth that we talked about.
Right.
So this is a kind of a brand new year, and it is lower, as I said, than we had predicted, and that I think was predicted in general. Okay.
My personal feeling before you move on is that typically, over the years that I've been following the ISM and following my own tools that I use within my own metal fabricating business, is that September typically is the turnaround month in a year where things are on the slower side. So, and matter of fact, I always look to our marketing year as starting in September. I kind of write off July, write off August, and then we do everything heading from September right through May of the following year. So I'm going to forecast right here now on Manufacturing Talk Radio, because I know that Brad doesn't like doing that. You're going to see an uptick next month. There, I said it.
Well,
I'm committed.
When that transpires, I will support you.
That's
a good thing, and I don't see anything that would preclude that from our data, and particularly if you look at our comments, which we went over most of them,
right,
is they're pretty positive about you know, the months ahead and the second half of the year, new product introductions and so on. So that could very well be the case, and it would be welcome indeed. All right, let me touch on
deliveries are up and inventories are down a little bit.
Yep. Supplier deliveries at 50.7. They've been down below 50 for a while, and we attribute that to, you know, the West Coast port situation to some degree, kind of you know, messing with the situation, but you know, and then opening up and allowing the flow much better and suppliers catching up. Now they're slowing back down again. It's more of a normal situation in a growth environment, just above 50. So another one to keep watching, but we like to see it above 50 in a growth environment. Inventories of raw materials down a point to 48.5. Contracting a little bit faster than last month. I think this is very much in a normal operating range. It's a little bit lean, not as a strategy, but just as, you know, a consequence of manufacturing and inventory control. So nothing to be concerned about there, very much in a normal operating range. Next, however, is perhaps a more interesting number, customer inventories, meaning finished goods at the end of production or on the customer shelves, at 53.0, in which we consider those finished goods inventories too high. And we haven't seen a number that high since March of 2009, when the reading was 54.0. So this is rather unusual, doesn't come around very often, and it increased 9 percentage points from last month's 44. So this is something to certainly watch and consider, and it may have the propensity to slow down new orders in view of the fact that customers are well stocked. Okay, so again, something to watch. Continuing on, let's talk next about some other indexes that we carry along the side that don't go directly into the PMI, but are nevertheless very important parts of the overall picture. Prices of raw materials decreasing for the 10th consecutive month. In other words, all year so far, down to 39.0, not the lowest point of the year, but down to 39, off 5 percentage points from last month. And if you look at the next page, or scroll down if you're looking at the website, we list commodities up and down in price and in short supply. Those commodities down in price include, you know, essentially all the metals, because it costs less to produce them due to the oil prices being down. So you'll see aluminum, copper, nickel, steel, stainless, even scrap metal, as well as diesel fuel and the resins and plastic products down, which contain directly oil-based components. So the impact of prices being down is hard felt in the petroleum and coal products industry, because they have to pull back projects and orders and employment. But for the other 17 industries, for the most part, this translates into good news, lower raw materials prices, lower cost of running our factories, and that's cited, both of those things are cited in our comments as well. Next, the backlog of orders up 4 percentage points to 46.5 from 42.5. Last month, for me, at 42.5, the backlog was starting to feel too low. We like to see it, you know, getting back up there, heading towards 50. That gives production more to work off of in the possible event that new orders aren't as strong as they're prepared for in terms of employment and production assets. Okay, so backlog of orders getting into better shape. The last two are imports and exports on our list in this table we call manufacturing at a glance. First, exports of finished goods products is contracting for the third consecutive month, down another point and a half to 46.5, and that is the lowest number since July of 2012. Certainly reflective of a couple of things: the high price of the dollar, and also, I think specifically China, and the concerns about, you know, their economy, or their level of growth at this point in time.
Okay. Brad, we've only got about 10 seconds left. I just want to thank you, and I don't mean to cut you short, but we are coming up on the end of the show. And
excellent.
Again, always want to thank you for being here. Your insight is terrific. And Tim?
And that kind of wraps us up for Manufacturing Talk Radio this week. Sorry we didn't have more time for Brad, but we'll be back soon.
Very good. Thank you.
Welcome to Manufacturing Talk Radio, the only show that takes a look at the... Thanks for joining us on Manufacturing Talk Radio. You can hear our next broadcast each Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at mfgtalkradio.com.